Blog Talk Radio.
Om Shabbat Shalom, Holy Way of the Most High. Om Shabbat Shalom, I sense your presence. Om Shabbat Shalom, Holy Way of the Most High. Om Shabbat Shalom, I sense your presence. And I am the light within your soul. In the essence of truth and right, love makes the circle whole. And here we stand in line, waiting for some sacred sign. But to find the balance is the purpose of this time. To restore the balance of the universal mind. And in the presence of my Lord of light and love, everything I see aspiring to be free. And when I call to thee and come on bended knee, surrender to the all-pervading light and love. Reflections of the one surrounding me with love. And I sense your presence. I sense your presence. I sense your presence. I sense your presence. Within and without, above and below, yeah. East, west, north and south, I sense your presence. Without and within, below and above, yeah, yeah. East, west, north and south, I sense your presence. I sense your presence. Presence of my Lord of light and love, everything I find in tune with the divine. And here we stand in line, waiting for some sacred sign. But to find the balance is the purpose of this time. Restore the balance of the universal mind. And I am the light within your soul. In the essence of truth and right, love makes the circle whole. And when I call to thee and come on bending knee, surrender to the all-pervading light and love. Reflections of the one surrounding me with love. For to find the balance is the purpose of this time. To restore the balance of the universal mind. And I sense your presence. I sense your presence. I sense your presence. I sense your presence. Om Shabbat Shalom, Holy Way of the Most High. Om Shabbat Shalom, I sense your presence. Om Shabbat Shalom, Holy Way of the Most High. Om Shabbat Shalom, I sense your presence. Om Shabbat Shalom, Holy Way of the Most High. Om Shabbat. and shalom. I sense your presence. Om Shabbat Shalom, Holy Angel of the Most High. Om Shabbat Shalom, I sense your presence. I sense your presence.
Thank you for joining me tonight here on Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. My name is Jessie Ann Nichols George, and I'm your hostess this evening. The music you were listening to at the beginning of the show is I Sense Your Presence. It's by Shemshai, great little group that I met when I was living in Arizona. And they're, of course, you know, traveling around the world, living their dream now. And you can always connect with them on Facebook. That's one area, or also their website area, which I want to say is shemshai.com. And that's S-H-I-M-S-H-A-I. And, yeah, great group. They've usually got a couple of free downloads from their website if you're interested in exploring their music a little bit more. And I just want to extend a welcome to you, whether you're joining us for the first time or whether you're coming back because you've enjoyed what I've done here before. Here at Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour, I look at different ways that compassion exists in our lives, how to remove our blocks, resistances, frustrations, and more. Some weeks I'm discussing different aspects of how compassion is in our life and how it affects our life and different areas of compassion. And then some weeks I'm doing more exercises, practical implementations. And most of the times, if you've experienced this year, if you've been following the show, I've got a lot of guests on, and I'm already putting together an amazing lineup for next year as well. Maybe a couple of little great hidden surprises coming up on that. I also occasionally highlight some musical artists along the way, and for those of you that have been listening, there's been Claire Hedin at the end of last year. We had Jill Mattson on this year, Stephen Halpern and Peter Cater, both Grammy nominees there with some pretty big work out there, to say the least. And I certainly encourage you to go back and check out those shows in our archives. I focus here on in my own work helping people find and use compassion in their everyday life. And I've created the Genesis Clearing Statement, which some of you have experienced on previous shows. And, of course, Kevin Baird, one of our other hosts, you can always catch him interviewing me about that and that work. And that happened, I want to say, around September, maybe late August, September kind of time frame last year, 2012. So you can check out all of that work there. I've authored 4 books. The most recent are You, Me, Life, Dreams, and also the companion workbook for that. And then in addition, I've created the Compassion Tour, which is a multi-state nationwide tour that includes workshops, retreats, seminars, book signings, and fundraising events. And I'm already working on creating that 2014 tour, so stay posted. I do know I'm going to be in the Santa Barbara area early March, and I will be recording for Bridging Heaven and Earth, a PBS TV show there. In that area, and actually they have that recording available for anybody who would like to come in and watch the taping happen. So you can stay tuned on that. That information will be up on my website, and you can follow other events for the tour at jessieannnicholsgeorge.eventbrite.com. And there's also an option there for gifting the tour, so you can't make it to an event or you live in another country but you want to support me getting out to the fundraisers, you can certainly donate any amount you choose right there. Just a reminder, if you enjoy the show this evening, make certain that you tell your friends, family, significant others, you know, make sure you share it with those social media connections out there, because I know myself, when I share things, I never know who's going to pick up on something and go, oh my gosh, that's exactly what I needed to find out about and exactly what I needed to hear about. Thank you for sharing that. So don't be afraid to put it out there and let other people know about it, because it may be exactly what they're looking for. They just use the same link, by the way, to come in to the archives that you use to get into the live show here, and that's available without restriction anytime. And it's actually available starting right after we complete the show. So very easy, very convenient, and then they can just listen there at their convenience for that. Now, before we get started, those of you that have listened in before, you know that I like to delve into this wonderful little book that I have here, The 72 Names of God, Technology for the Soul. It's put together by Yehuda Berg, which is a Kabbalah master. And I like his work just because he takes the big concepts and he simplifies them down into our everyday life. And that's what I like to do with my work too, because I feel like, hey, it's got to get in there where you understand it. It's got to be in there where it applies for you. And the more it does that, then the more you're going to take hold and you're going to use that information. So what I like to do is to kind of randomly open here and find out what our message is, because as we know, when we do it, it always comes to us, whatever is the message for the week. And by the way, this message then is posted on my website, JessieAnnNicholsGeorge1.com, and I put that up usually right after the show, and you'll find that on my page on the Main Street Universe tab there. So let's see what Yehuda's message is tonight here. Okay, we have diffusing negative energy and stress. Wow, I think this is going to be something a lot of people can use right now. When we encounter places oozing negative energy, if we come in contact with people radiating darkness, anger, or hatred, when pressure increases, this name will neutralize any and all negative forces, including stress and nervous tension. And then the message he provides with this is, or the insight he provides is, according to Kabbalah, we all have a spiritual field of energy that extends a little more than 7 feet from our bodies. Although we can't see this field with the naked eye, it's as real as the invisible atoms in the air and as undeniable and influential as the unseen force of gravity. Whenever this field is charged with negative or stressed out energy, we find ourselves in a lower state of being, suffering from sadness, stress, depression, hostility, fear, and uncertainty. Or we just feel plain miserable. Unpleasant places and gloomy people influence our lives when we come into close contact with them. Our personal space is violated, charged with disturbing energy detrimental to our well-being. And the meditation that he gives with this is, purifying light banishes unseen, ominous forces and deactivates harmful influences lurking nearby, including those that dwell inside you. Stress dissolves, pressure is released, balance and positive energy permeate your environment. And I think this is really going to apply with our guest tonight, because with his work, he really delves into how to get past some of these blocks. And I think a lot of times when we get the blocks that come up, it's because we've gotten bombarded with some of this negative energy and we haven't taken the time to bring that positive light in. He also works with some things that are related to the heart space, and we're going to be delving into that, finding out more of what that's all about. Now, again, the common name here for this name of God is diffusing negative energy and stress. And the way this name is pronounced is Kaf Hei Tav. Kaf Hei Tav. And again, that will be up on my website. You can go back and read on that and reflect on that throughout the week. And you'll have that to access. I've been tongue-twisting today. It's really something. So let's do a little lead up here to what our guest is going to be discussing tonight, what our topic is, and let's take a look at this. A little something to ponder here before we go on break. How often have you tried to force your way through something? Have you focused so hard on trying to find a solution only to find yourself standing in the same place, stuck? Have you ever thought you didn't have time to play or indulge in stepping outside of a schedule or other boundaries? This is the way that many people tend to operate. However, as we grow spiritually, we realize that forcing our way through doesn't necessarily work. Oftentimes, when we think we don't have time and won't allow for any variation from plans and schedules, we actually end up taking longer to get things done and feel more drained doing it. These patterns can then easily cascade into difficulties into multiple areas of life instead of just where it originated. When we fall into force and structure too much, we lose a very powerful piece of having flow, abundance, and harmony in our life. That piece is our creative energy. When this energy gets pushed down and ignored, we are certain to start seeing things like headaches, frustration, aggression, and feeling completely depleted and at times even defeated. Jack Elias talks about connecting to the inner power and intelligence that comes with using creative energy. He says that from a space of creative energy, especially when used in combination with heart energy or compassion, one can create anything to happen in their life. He says that any change can happen. When we open ourselves to working with creative energy, we are also opening ourselves to true magic. This creative energy breaks up the stagnation that is in our lives. In turn, we open ourselves to all possibilities that lead to a fulfilling, rewarding, abundant lifestyle. We can heal on many levels and transcend all perceived boundaries around us. Creativity can actually be seen as the union of two words, create and activity. It is creating action in our lives. What can you do to embrace your creative energy? When was the last time you did something that didn't need to be done in a specific way? Are you willing to spend a few minutes a day being creative to get unstuck instead of spending hours spinning your wheels going nowhere? This week, our guest focuses on a component of compassion that is related to the aspect in my books known as loving yourself. This reminds us to honor who we are and what we need. It reminds us that we need to step out of the boundaries imposed on us and stay connected to our heart and allow ourselves time to be free and open. I'm going to take a short break, and when we return, I will have Jack Elias with us. He will be sharing his work in Finding True Magic. And the song I've got for you during our break is called The Chosen One. It's by Claire Hedin. You can definitely check out more of her work at www.clairehedin.com. That's CLAREHEDIN.com. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Your eyes shine with kindness, your hair curls with joy, your heart lights the bedroom, your grace fills the sky. You are the chosen one, so bright just like the sun. You are so blessed, be you are a joy to me. Your name sings the heaven, and nature hears it too. Imagination whispers, creating life through you. You are the chosen whisper, so bright just like the sun. You fill my heart with gladness, you do for everyone. Oh,
a joy, a joy.
my joy, you're my delight. You are the one I love, that I adore. You are the one my life was created for. You are the one I love, so blessed be. You are a joy to me.
And welcome back. You are listening to Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. My name is Jessie Ann Nichols George, and I am your hostess this evening. You were just listening to The Chosen One. It's by Claire Hedin. And again, if you'd like to find out more about her music, you can certainly do so at www.clairehedin.com. That's C-L-A-R-E-H-E-D-I-N.com. And I'd like to bring on my guest here tonight, Jack Elias, who is a certified NLP practitioner, that's a neuro-linguistic programming practitioner, for over 30 years. He's done clinical and Ericksonian hypnotherapist. Jack is trained in altered states processes, Zen Buddhism, Buddhist and Siddha yoga for over 45 years. He has authored Finding True Magic, which blends hypnosis, NLP, and various meditative techniques to create a dynamic process of change. He is the founder and director of the Institute for Therapeutic Learning and a vocational school offering transpersonal hypnotherapy, or NLP, and certification trainings, seminars, and mentorship programs. Jack's mission is to help people get everything they really want, which happens through accessing the true magic that exists in the mind and comes from meeting any situation with confidence. And we're looking tonight at his work with Accessing the Creative Mind. You can also learn more about Jack's work at www.findingtruemagic.com. That's at the bottom of the show description tonight. And I'm just working on going ahead and getting his mic opened up. Jack, it is absolutely wonderful to have you here on Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour.
Thank you, Jesse. The way you pronounce my last name is Elias.
Elias. Okay,
Elias.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm happy to be here, and I must say I really enjoyed the opening of the show. Those were wonderful pieces.
Well, thank you so much. It's it's such a pleasure to bring it in, and I love just bringing in a little piece of insight, for the topic and my guest, and I think it just kind of sets us all up for the evening here. Jack, I would love to have you start off by sharing about yourself. Give us a little background to who you are and what got you onto this path for this work that you're doing now with Finding True Magic and working with creativity and all of these different avenues.
Okay. I think, like most people who are drawn to healing professions, there was an affinity right from when we were very young. I feel very fortunate that I had a mother who had the ability and capacity and made it her priority to be very loving to me. And I felt like her love, like especially putting me to bed at night, made it very easy for me to connect with a sense of presence and love that was greater than just her loving me. And I was raised a Christian, so the label I put that on that was God, and it was a very tangible living presence, and I would attribute it now to her. The way she lovingly related to me was like a gateway. So from very early on, I was had the benefit and the blessing of being sensitive to the presence of sacredness in life. And I probably for a while thought I would be a priest. And but that kind of gave way to a greater interest in science and mathematics as I got older. I thought I would be an astronomer when I went to college, because that sense of sacredness was equally there and in fact heightened in studying math and science for me, because it especially mathematics just kind of laid open this incredible all-pervasive intelligent functioning of the universe. So it wasn't dry and dead like a lot of people think of mathematics. So it was very kind of mystical, in fact. But when I got to college, I had a very strong detour, which I'm assuming most of your audience knows the term karma. It's the law of cause and effect, and it's actually very simple. It's not that esoteric, but the words from the Eastern religions sometimes confuse us, and karma is one of those words that we have a lot of trouble with. But basically, seems like I had a rendezvous. I picked up this little book called Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, and it was a little translation of these short little pithy stories and kind of mental puzzles that are part of the Zen Buddhist tradition. And I just opened it up in my room. I was a freshman in college, and I read just a couple of these, and just this huge upwelling of joy and recognition came up, and I literally started dancing around the room and had this very strong feeling like I had come home. And at the same time, recognized that I had been carrying a kind of sadness that I hadn't been home. But it was so far in the background, it never occurred to me until that moment that I had a sense always that I wasn't really home. And so this made me very interested, obviously, in Zen Buddhism. But this was 1966, and there was hardly anything around at that time. There were a couple books by D.T. Suzuki, but other than that, there was pretty much nothing. But I did read one or two of those books, and at the end of my sophomore year, I had my interest in college had evolved from science into history and religion and philosophy. And so I was planning to go on in that direction in my finishing up my college years. But at the end of my sophomore year, I had this big spiritual experience. And then the next day, somebody handed me a brochure about the first Zen Buddhist monastery opening in America. And 2 weeks later, I was there. And that monastery is very well known now. It's called Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, and it's the monastic location that's affiliated with the San Francisco Zen Center. And the teacher there was one of the seminal Buddhist teachers to come to the West, and I just had the good fortune to just fall into that without really any searching whatsoever. His name was Shunryu Suzuki, and his title is Roshi. That's for the title of a Zen master, so his name was Suzuki Roshi. And there's a classic, what's now a classic book on meditation called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that is edited from transcripts of talks he gave. So I got to study with this fantastic being for 5 years, practicing Zen Buddhist meditation and study for 5 years, both at the city center and also at the monastery in Tassajara. And in about a year or so, he died in 1971. And about a year before he died, another teacher from a different Buddhist tradition, from a Tibetan Buddhist tradition, had come to America, and he came and visited. And his name was Chogyam Trungpa. And his title, his honorific title, is Rinpoche, which is what all the equivalent of Zen masters in the Tibetan tradition are called, Rinpoches. So his name was Trungpa Rinpoche. And it became immediately clear to me that when Suzuki Roshi passed away, I would go study with him. And that's what I did. I'd studied with Suzuki Roshi till he died. That was 5 years studying with him. And then I went to study with Trungpa Rinpoche in Boulder, Colorado, and I was there with him for 16 years, and then he passed away. But over the course of that time, it became clear to me I would not be a priest. And in fact, I got married and I had a bunch of kids. But this sense of having a connection, a spiritual connection, and that there was something I had been blessed with to communicate to people in terms of serving people and helping them in a compassionate way, I was doing that as best I could in the work I did, which was in sales. Like when I got married, I realized I had to get a real job, and so I started selling real estate and also added insurance and some other things after that. But even though I was serving people, I always felt like the product was in the way. And like there must be, you know, that I wanted, there's something I had to share with people directly without there being a product in the way. But by this time of having a level of frustration about it, I had four kids, and so I had this idea in my mind, well, I can't make a change now because, you know, I've got to keep things going. You know, I might lose everything. You know, it's the typical way we often think when we want to change something is that we might lose what we have. So, but one thing that did happen that confirmed for me that I had been very fortunate to, as I said before, fall into studying with these very, very special beings was that I went to, in 1980, I went to a neuro-linguistic programming training where I got certified. And I was probably the only one in the class, about 30 people or 40 people, I was probably the only one who wasn't a psychologist. And they were all being just shocked and blown away by what was being presented in neuro-linguistic programming. But for me, it was very familiar, and it was like little bits and pieces of what I had already been studying and learning in Buddhist psychology and philosophy. So I was shocked, and I thought, you know, if they're not teaching you this, if you're studying psychology in college and they're not teaching you this, what are they teaching you? And, you know, so that made me feel better about the fact that I had never completed college, because when I had that big experience and then somebody handed me the brochure and then I went to the monastery, that was at the end of my sophomore year, and I never went back to college. So that removed any bad feeling I had about that. It's like, you know, I did make the right decision. Clearly I had made the right decision, at least for, you know, my interests. So I carried this problem about what do I do? I can't stop working. So in 1986, in August of 1986, my oldest child, my daughter Sarah, who was 10 at that time, was diagnosed with pulmonary hypertension, which is a closing off of the blood vessels in the lungs. And it's a terminal illness, and there's no treatment for it. And she had been having trouble for months, and we finally took her, and they diagnosed it, and they put her on oxygen. And for comfort, it's not a treatment, it just makes it easier for someone to get oxygen. And we were living in Boulder, Colorado, which is 6,000 feet, so they told us, you know, you should move to sea level as soon as possible. So within a matter of weeks, we were completely uprooted from our life, our friends, our spiritual teacher, everything. And we, as searching the East Coast and the West Coast, we finally picked Orcas Island, which is up here in the Puget Sound in Washington State. And we moved there, and I was my daughter's primary caregiver. She was on oxygen 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 5 years. And I was her primary caregiver, and basically over that time spent all of our assets and savings. And so the irony of ironies is that when pretty much I'd lost everything was when I began my career as a hypnotherapist. And, you know, the irony being I told myself, you can't begin a career as a hypnotherapist because you might lose everything.
So, those excuses, you know, that we make and then come full too.
You know, I'm very good at what I do, and it's not because I'm smart, it's because I made all the mistakes myself.
We all have different ways to learn, Jack.
So I moved to Seattle from Orcas Island with my daughter in 88, and I took a class in hypnotherapy, and immediately was obvious that I really already knew this stuff. And the teacher was very courageous and very generous. Instead of feeling threatened, they just invited me to immediately to start teaching with them, even though it was my first training. And I taught with this man, his name was James Maynard, and we taught his version of transpersonal hypnotherapy, which was more theosophically based. And then when he left town and I took over about 2 years later, I transformed it and made it much more from the point of view of my Buddhist training, still keeping the theosophical elements but kind of expanding it. So I have been training and teaching and having a private practice ever since 1988. And my daughter passed away in 92, and when she passed away, then all my other kids came to live with me, so I was a single dad for many years with three teenagers, and that was a lot of fun and very instructive.
That's more than a handful and a half.
To take
them on at the teenage stage. I mean, I think even people who have lived with them all their lives are challenged by that age range, having them that time.
Yeah, they were, I think it was like from 8, 12, and 14.
Wow. Okay, so you had a little bit of space in
that. Now I'm a granddad, and I have four beautiful grandchildren.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah. And so, you know, in 1985, I finally published my book. It's been around a long time now, Finding True Magic, Transpersonal Hypnotherapy. And I'm very gratified and very grateful that it's, you know, many people consider it a classic in the field. It's been around a long time and still very used by a lot of people and very highly regarded. And again, it's not because I'm so special. It's because I was smart enough to and lucky enough to live in a very close relationship with these extraordinary teachers. And the thing about them is what makes a master is that they become or they are a living embodiment of the teachings. It's not just a head trip. I had a client today, and we were talking about Nelson Mandela, and she had seen him when he came to Seattle many years ago and went to a talk he gave, and she said that, you know, he didn't say anything that special, but the quality of his presence was overwhelming. And that's what my teachers were. These beings who completely were a manifestation of compassion and love and wisdom, not merely talking about it. So even though wasn't that great a student, the fact that when you hang out with someone like that, you know, it gets into you. So I feel very much, you know, that I'm just sharing what was given to me. And it's very precious and very rare, but not because it's something I invented. It's just something I get to share.
Well, and I think you bring up a good point. I mean, do we ever truly invent anything in that capacity? You know, we're constantly bringing forward what's already been, but maybe expanding on that or adding a different piece or putting different pieces together. And it sometimes seems like we've invented something or created something.
Yeah.
And I think you bring up a great point. There's so many people that are looking for this big, you know, wow factor with somebody. And as you say, the wow factor is oftentimes more the presence that's there, the follow-through, the living the message, the showing the message in action, which is, I think, what really brings it home to truth in that capacity. And I, you know, I find that it is kind of that mixture, and every now and then when you find somebody that's saying something, that's like, oh, yeah, I get it, that's it. But here again, I can say that people might be getting, for example, something I put out there because of the way I present it, but it's not that it's necessarily anything brand new that's out there.
Right. You know, I find that we, because of the, from around that time of the 60s, for all you old hippies out there, you know, when the Eastern teachings started to really come to the West, that, you know, it's been a real struggle for us how to understand it. And one of the ways that we get mixed up is what we could call not understanding how to relate to the absolute and the relative. And what we do is we hear these absolute truths, you know, about love and be detached, and you know, we take those conceptual formulations of absolute truth, and we try to act them out in our relative lives, and it doesn't work. And just a good illustration, I think, is a friend of mine was kind of on, not guard duty, he was on, he was like a monitor for interviews with our teacher, and, you know, so he would let people know when it was their turn to go in with the teacher. And our teacher, you know, his whole message was love, and that you are God, you're one with God, you're not this little temporary being, you're, you know, and don't get trapped in all the pettiness of clinging as this petty little being, that you're a being of love, you deserve to completely honor and worship yourself, and for that matter, everyone else. Welcome everyone with love. And so my friend knew that one of the people waiting in line was a woman who had just lost her child. And so my friend was fantasizing how our teacher would tell her that, you know, it's just an illusion. Your child's not really dead. It's just this passing show, you know, and, you know, just let go of that, let go of all of that, and just realize that we're all God, something, you know, magnificent and ultimate and absolute is what he was expecting. he would tell her. So he ushered her in, and that, you know, he just couldn't resist. His curiosity got the best of him. So instead, so he peeked in. He wasn't supposed to, you know, it was supposed to be a private interview. But he peeked in, and what he saw just shocked him to his core, because instead of seeing what he thought, which was our teacher sitting up on his higher seat and the person, you know, you sit on the floor at your teacher's feet, instead of him being up there giving her these wonderful pronouncements, what he saw was that our teacher was down on the floor hugging this woman, and they were both racked with sobs. He completely joined her in her suffering from the heart, you know, completely letting go. No, you know, it was not a place for concepts. It was a place for total heart connection, being completely human and vulnerable to heartbreak. That is the supreme teaching. And we have, you know, we've made it harder for ourselves to go there because of our misunderstanding of some of the ways absolute teachings about love have been presented. You know, especially if it's been presented in terms of that you should be detached, that you have to detach from your desires. And so people think, okay, I'm going to get detached and I'm not going to have desires. And actually they just become cold-hearted because they're trying to act it out on the relative level, a mistaken notion of what that absolute teaching means. You know, being detached doesn't mean, you know, become like a prune. You know?
Well, and I think that that is a term that really is a one that maybe is easily misunderstood, and I'm glad that you brought up this example of, with the teacher, because this is one of the things that I feel like shows the difference sometimes between a so-called real teacher in something versus somebody who's just feeding you information. And that real teacher is not afraid to get down and be at your side. They don't have to always remain so-called above you or this sort of thing. They don't have to maintain that position all the time. They understand when it's time to be you know, face-to-face there, to be in that different space. And the detachment factor is an important thing, I think, because like you said, it gets very confused. People think, well, I've got to be detached now, and then they really shut down their emotional body, which ironically, at least in my experience, is a huge key to having our connection. It's a huge key to our heart space and our compassion space in things. And yet the detachment, as I've learned it anyways or come to know it, is beneficial to us when we detach from, say, forcing our will or from having to have a specific outcome in things, as opposed to detaching from ourselves or our emotions or that level.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great way to put it. I tell people that, like, this thing about you're not supposed to have desires, it's not. And that the Buddha, you know, the Buddha said that grasping is the root of suffering, and you should practice desirelessness. And that's a mistranslation. It's, you know, we, as any living organism on Earth, we are all desire beings, and all that means is that moment by moment, we desire everything that we need to stay alive. You know, we desire food, we desire oxygen, we're constantly having desires, and that's perfectly natural. What causes suffering is when we grasp at a desire, and grasping at a desire is a fiction, because the desire is not an object. We create ideas about desires, And those ideas are conceptual objects, and we think we can grasp them, like I'm holding on to you, you know, or I'm holding on to my car, you know. But that's just conceptual thinking. What's actually happening is you're squeezing yourself, you know, and we miss that. People have elaborate notions about what they're holding on to and what they're trying to control. Everybody has, you know, control issues, and because of our ideas, our awareness is directed outward towards these objects that we've created, meaning these concepts that we've created. We think we're dealing with something out there, but really all we're doing when we're grasping or controlling, all we're doing is squeezing our being. And that is unhealthy, and it actually doesn't help ever. You know, the functional demonstration of fear is that we squeeze ourselves. And if you recognize this, that's all it is, then you can start to develop an interest in releasing your attachment to fear. When you realize it's not this big castle of ideas you've built up, that's just a distraction that you've created from recognizing you're squeezing your heart or you're squeezing your gut, you know. And if you realize it's that simple and that elemental, then it's easy to recognize that it's never your friend. But if you don't realize that, I've had people tell me all the time that they wouldn't know what to do without their fear, that their fear is what motivates them, that their fear is what helps them accomplish things. And I always, one of the things I tell them, besides pointing out the squeezing notion, is that, in terms of how this world runs, which is it runs according to the law of cause and effect, you know, which is called karma in the East. Everything is according to the law of cause and effect. If you plant a corn seed, you're not going to get plum trees. And in the same way, if you recognize good fruit that you've created in your life by your efforts, that good fruit had to come from a good seed. So the good seed is your own good qualities and your own good effort. And it wasn't because of the fear. I would say that, you know, your fear didn't get you out of bed and cause you to create those good consequences for yourself. Your good intentions created those things for yourself in spite of the fear. And that without the fear draining your energy, those good consequences that you value in your life would be even better. It's just, you know, fear is not our friend ever, and it's never a choice. It's never relevant in any situation. It's never a part of the equation to squeeze yourself. It never helps you function. If you have a challenge coming at you, you want to be at your best. It's like an image I often use with people is if you're walking down an alley late at night and suddenly you see three shady-looking characters come around the other end of the alley, and you're very certain that this is a bad thing and you're going to have to take care of yourself. Resorting to fear would be like thinking, well, the first thing I have to do is tie my shoelaces together and then try to run away. It just doesn't help.
Yes, and I think that's the thing, is so many people get locked into that space with fear there. And I like your description of kind of squeezing yourself. And I think anybody who's maybe been through panic attacks or things like that could definitely relate it to that feeling. You do. You feel squished in. You feel restricted. And when we're feeling restricted, we know that's a surefire sign that we're in the space of fear. And And I think that kind of leans into your work that deals with opening our creative energy, because that creative energy then seems to help us move out of that space of fear. It kind of, loosens up the restraints that we put on ourselves.
Let's use another image, is that we're like a garden hose, and that creative energy and that creative force is the water going through the hose. And if you have something that you need to water, and you crimp the hose, then you're not going to be able to water it. And that's what happens when we think we have to be afraid, is we actually crimp the hose of our creative energies. But we can get so confused that we turn things upside down, and we think, not merely think, but we develop a habit so we don't even have to think about it anymore, which is that if a challenge comes our way, our first response is to get afraid, is to crimp the hose, and then try to deal with the problem. When the thing to do is to cultivate a habit that's opposite to that, which is that the first thing to do when you recognize you're being confronted with a challenge, the first thing to do would be to relax, to profoundly relax, and open with faith and confidence to your own inner resourcefulness, to your own creative wellspring. And the thing that stops us from doing that, the reason why we've cultivated the mistaken habit of going to fear, is that we all have experienced in varying degrees growing up in our childhood judgments, that it's not okay, that we're not okay, and that our value as a being is at stake in our performance. So we become afraid of success and failure and being judged, as opposed to being given the understanding to, just do your best. Life is a learning curve. Do your best. Enjoy the process. We get robbed of that in varying degrees. We have parents who don't understand what parenting is, and even though they may deep down love us, nevertheless, at an operational level, they give us a very strong, convincing message that if we don't fulfill their desires or their needs, if we don't please them, then we're worthless, and they'll withdraw their love. That can develop in many different facets, and we don't grow out of that. This is where hypnotherapy comes in. The creative power of our mind is the power of imagining. Most people don't realize that all of life is imagining. They might think, oh, well, you're just imagining that, and dismiss the imagining power. But all of our fears are imaginary. All of our hopes are imaginary. Whenever we create something, it's because first we have an image. We create an image, and then we figure out how to manifest it in outer reality. That's true about trains and planes and automobiles and cell phones. Everything is the creative function manifests images, imaginings, and then we figure out how to manifest it. And that holds true for manifesting our storylines about who we are and what life is about and what's going to make us a good person or a bad person. All of that is hypnotic suggestion. Hypnotic suggestion is just that. It's a suggestion about how to imagine what reality is. People all think, gee, I don't know if I can be hypnotized, because there's all this prevailing information about what hypnosis is, a large part of it coming from stage hypnosis, which is entertainment. And people see people doing outrageous things, and they don't want to be doing outrageous things, and they're afraid maybe they can be hypnotized, and then there are people who think they can't be hypnotized. And the fact is, we're hypnotized all the time. Language is inherently hypnotic. Who we think we are is a bundle of hypnotic trances. And this is a basic understanding from these Eastern traditions that I've studied, and it's very rare to find it emphasized in Western literature and Western teachings. And in fact, the West, you know, and with our individualism, we, you know, cherish this, what we can call ego, this idea of self, and we don't question it. And yet it's the root of our problems, clinging and grasping to an idea of self as if it's who we really are. That's the grasping that causes our suffering. And it's all a function of misusing language, of accepting negative hypnotic suggestions, like I'm not worthy. Most people carry around, if you're not joyful, it's because you think you're not worthy. If you're not joyful all the time, in my opinion, it's because you have some tape in your head, which is nothing but hypnotic suggestion, you know, telling you you're not worthy, telling you you're not allowed to be joyful, or you don't deserve to be joyful. And then, of course, there's all kinds of justifications for that. But none of them are true. And all of those things, what they serve to do functionally is they create the crimp in the hose that blocks your creative energy from flowing in a very joyful, and our creative energy is naturally joyful, naturally loving, compassionate, and inclusive, and anything that manifests from that creative energy in a way that's not restrained by those kinks, it automatically benefits others as well as yourself. So,
and
it's effortlessly inclusive.
And that joyfulness that's coming out, you know, just for people that are wondering out there, because sometimes you and I can talk on things and think, oh, somebody should put these pieces together. When we talk about being joyful, we're not necessarily talking about the person who goes skipping up and down the street, you know, tossing flowers out of a basket or whatever. You know, sometimes that joyfulness is just an inner feeling of sort of peace or acceptance, or you know, you're okay. Even when things can be chaotic, you're okay. There, you have a sense of joy for what you do have in there. So I don't want people to think that all of a sudden they have to be this happy, big, giant, toothy grin all over the place all the time.
I would. That's an excellent point, because I know that, you know, that's what we can do, is we try to create an idea. Well, what must that be? And what I would just say, remember your roots, you know, and your roots are that you're being given the gift of life breath by breath, and that the joy I'm talking about is that you don't become numb or take that for granted. You actually feel kind of an astonishment, a constant delightful astonishment that you even exist. And it's very vibrant and peaceful at the same time. It's very rich, and it's welcoming, because when you're sensitive to the fact that you're being given birth moment by moment, you realize that that's the case with everything and everyone around you, that we're all being given birth together moment by moment. We're all part of the same miracle, and we're all brothers and sisters. And so the joy isn't simply skipping around and kind of Pollyanna throwing flowers. It's very deep. It's profoundly deep, and can manifest as the serenity and magnetism of being that we talked about earlier about Nelson Mandela, and that I said that that's how my teachers were as well. It's profound. It's a profound awareness of being alive. And it can include it can include happy and joyful, the typical happy and joyful, but it also includes heartbreak, the capacity to profoundly relate and fearlessly experience heartbreak and not be defeated by it and not build a poor me story around it, but that the joy is still there even in profound heartbreak. That's the kind of joy I'm talking about.
Right, and this is the type of thing where we know, for example, even when somebody passes on from this life, and yes, of course, we will miss them as a human being, but then at the same time, there's a profound joy for the accomplishment of passing on that goes with it, and I think that might be an example of that kind of a parallel. We're in times right now, I know, with some of the influences that we have, that this is really coming home. There's a bittersweetness that's going on. It's like letting go of that love that doesn't work in your life anymore, but then you've got this profound joy at the same time of moving forward. So you've got sorrow, but you've got joy with it. And so it's that sort of bittersweetness, and it's an awe, I think, of the whole process. So let me ask you this, Jack. People, you know, they go, okay, great. I get that I'm in this fear space, and I get that I need to open up my creative energy. But how do I do that?
Yeah, great question. The good news is, you don't have to do, you know, implied in that is that people, we think we have to create the creativity. You're already perfectly creative. It's, to go back to the hose thing, the hose is already there, the water is already there. You don't have to create the water, or you don't have to create the force of the flow of the water. You just have to remove the crimp. So it's not about creating the goodness. It's about stop creating the unnecessary squeezing, and immediately the goodness will flow. Immediately the creative will flow. If you've ever had the experience of, you know, struggling with a dilemma and being afraid, and then one way or another you release the fear, maybe even accidentally, and suddenly your mind is full of ideas of how to address the challenge. And it's joyful and it's enthusiastic, whereas a second before you just felt like you were just a caved-in black hole. I tell my clients and my students that you never are without your power. You always have all your power and you always have all your freedom. You're absolutely free and you have all your power all the time. The thing is, that absolute freedom means just that. You're absolutely free. And that means if you choose to follow negative hypnotic suggestions, if you choose to follow negative thinking, that you, by following it, you twist up your creative energy, you twist up your power around itself, you create pain and suffering. And you mislabel that as, I'm trapped, I'm in prison, I have no power. No, that's a misinterpretation. What you've done, the intensity of your suffering is the demonstration of the presence of your power. If your power wasn't there, the suffering couldn't be intense. It'd be like a limp noodle. So it's not that you don't, if you're suffering intensely, it's not that you've lost your power or that you've lost your freedom. It's that you've used your free ability to use your power, only you've misused your power. You've turned it against yourself and created a squeezing or a knot, if you will, and that's painful. But it's a demonstration of the use of your power, the free use of your power. So it's not about finding your power. It's not about finding your freedom. It's about recognizing what you're doing with your power and freedom and going in the other direction. Because in the same way, if you choose negative thinking and confused thinking, you can create infinite suffering for yourself and nothing will get in the way because you're absolutely free. But by the same token, if you follow creative and generative and uplifting and kind thinking, you can create unlimited, blissful, joyful benefit, and nothing will get in the way because you're absolutely free. Either way, you're absolutely free. You have all your power all the time. And if you remember that and find yourself suffering, instead of complaining, you can think, what am I doing right now to create this? You take ownership of it. You stand in the position of power and choice. What am I doing? What thoughts am I following? What do I have to be believing right now to be creating this mess or this pain? And that's the way you start to change it. Not by having a false problem of, I don't have any power, or I don't have any freedom. You know, that's creating a false problem, and so you waste your energy doing things that are never going to help. You know, people often say, you know, I've tried everything, and then they get defeated. I've tried everything. Nothing works. You know, and this is another quality of the hypnotic and beguiling power of language. You can, if you say, I try everything and nothing works, and then you believe it. But really all that's happened is that you've tried everything that doesn't work. So, of course, nothing changed. It's like if you wanted to turn the light off in a room and you exhausted yourself going around the room, moving the furniture, slapping the walls, you know, ruffling the curtains and digging around in the rug and saying, I've tried everything and nothing works. But really what's happened is you just didn't do the one simple thing that does work, which is go over and flip the switch. Everything has a solution. Everything has a switch, but we're blinded to where the switch is by the hypnotic quality of the language that we have been habituated to using in a self-defeating way. And, you know, I realize we're just beginning to get into something that we could go on about for a very long time, and yet we're running out of time. But I would like to say that this is what my book is about. I have a lot of things at my website that go into this, and this is what my work is about. I want you all to understand you have all your power all the time, and you're absolutely free. And just, you don't have to believe me, but just try, just as an experiment. If you have something in your life, assume that you have all your power and all your freedom, and then ask, what am I doing? What do I have to be believing to be creating this right now, or to be willing to stay in relationship to this right now? What do I have to be believing? What am I doing?
And
then you can start to recognize. What?
I was going to say, and you bring up an aspect in there when you gave your example of how we get so busy on this doing. You know, we're busy moving the furniture and touching the wall and adjusting the curtains. And what we need to do is stop and be still and really look around the room.
Yeah, right.
So that we can see.
Oh, there it is.
and it's that stillness.
Yeah.
It's that quietness that reopens and goes, oh, that's it.
Yeah. There's a wonderful story about you. That was a wonderful book you brought up with all the names of God. In that same tradition, there's all kinds of stories about Nasruddin. You know, sometimes he's a fool, sometimes he's a sage, sometimes he's all kinds of things. But they're teaching stories, and there's one of my favorites is that one night Nasruddin comes home from a big party, partying all night, and it's early in the morning, and he's drunk, and he's stumbling home, and he gets to his door, and he can't get in. He doesn't have his keys. He's realized he's lost his keys, so he goes back out into the street, and he's crawling around on the street under the streetlight looking for his keys, and one of his neighbors, his friends, comes by and says, Nasruddin, what are you doing? And he says, I can't get in my house. I lost my keys. And the friend says, oh, well, gee, let me help you. So he gets down, and they're both spending some time looking around, and they look everywhere in the field of this street light, and finally his friend says, you know, geez, Nasruddin, I don't know. I don't think your keys are here. Can you rethink it? Maybe you lost them somewhere else. And Nasruddin says, well, yeah, I did. I lost them in the alley. And his friend just looks at him in shock and says, well, then why are we looking for them here? And Nasruddin looks at him like he's a fool, and he says, well, because this is where the light is.
we kind of buy into these things.
Yeah.
You know, advertising such a great example of that, that we buy into these things. We're told we've got to have this in our life or got to have that in our life, or, you know, this will make you happy, and if you do this, then you'll be the best on the block or something like that. And really, it comes down to, you know, you win when you've got the happiness. You win when you're fulfilled, so to say. And we need to look, as you say, we need to look where we lost it, or look, you know, where we think back maybe where we noticed the connection was missing in things. Now, I know, Jack, with your techniques that I think almost most areas of life people can shift using your techniques.
Yes.
But let's take a sensitive one for people right now. We have a lot going on in our world and our economy, and there's been a lot of people that have lost jobs or things like that along the way. So how do people get improvement in, say, something like finances or relationships from using this creativity?
The fear never helps. So the thing to do is to, as best you can, relax and invite, you know, depending on your beliefs, your belief system can make a difference. You want to use what works for you. Is, you know, the way I would put it is invoke grace, invite beneficial guidance from whatever source you feel is available to you. Relax and open to that, and then make your best effort to move forward with a sense of self-encouragement, encouragement to those around you, build relationships, build networks. Do the opposite of what fear wants you to do. Like, fear wants us to contract and to grasp. One of the best ways to discover the way to a new life is to be generous. To be generous to yourself and to be generous to those around you. And one aspect of generosity is brainstorming, which is engaging your creative powers together. And when you're doing it together, when you find ways to be in relationship and to others to do it, it's also much easier to let go of fear, because you can reflect confidence and love to each other, and you can talk about the fears that are trying to get us. That, you know, fear is all imaginary. Fear is imaginary. It's not real. And I want to distinguish between, I'm talking about psychological fear. It's imaginary. I'm not talking about the fight or flight response. That's not fear. That's the fight and flight response. It's built-in response as a survival tool. That is not fear. Psychological fear is a story about me and what's going to happen to me. That's, you know, negative hypnotic suggestions, and it never helps. And, you know, people often object. Well, people say, well, bad things could happen. Of course bad things can happen, but living in fear keeps that hose crimped. It keeps you squeezing yourself, degrading your health, degrading your ability to connect to your creativity. So, yes, it's possible that bad things can happen. But if you're going to have to meet a challenge, what do you think would be the best way to meet it? having spent your time degrading your health and your faith in yourself by constantly worshiping at the feet of fearful imaginings, or by keeping yourself uplifted and encouraged with love, and then when you meet a challenge, you just do your best. You just do your best. You might not get what you want, but you'll discover that without fear, what Jesse just said is that the answer is not the outer performance or the outer success. You have everything when you have your own inner love and inner peace and inner sense of your own worthiness, so that if something outside doesn't work out, you still can be gracious and to yourself, and you still can create healthy relationships with other people and find a way through with community, whether it be just one other person or a neighborhood or whatever. You know, I find that people, it's very rare for people to have healthy family systems, which is a form of community. You know, there's so much confusion, so much fear that people carry, so much unfinished business and resentment that, especially in America, the character, you can see it in our politics today, it's very much about, attacking and creating rigid separations, and it's terrible. It's tragic. And
I think you've brought up something that is actually very easy for people to do if they will allow themselves to do it. And there's so many resources for doing this, for connecting with community. I mean, we look at all the groups that are online now. We look at, groups in LinkedIn we can belong to, groups in Facebook we can belong to, here on Blog Talk Radio, all the different shows you can tap into, all of these different things. Networking with people and brainstorming with other people, even if that's one other person, such as our partner or friend or neighbor or whoever it is, or sibling or whatever. Because what I see in all of this parallel is when we're in that fear, we're isolating ourselves. We're shutting ourselves off like in this room. But when we step out and we communicate with people and we step out and we start talking to somebody else, we realize, something bad could happen, but something good could happen too.
Mm-hmm. I saw, I guess it's a couple years ago, when the crash happened, and they interviewed this man, this white man in the South, and he was sharing how he had lost everything. And all his life he had been racist, and he had not associated with black people, and there were plenty of black people around where he lived. He was in the South. And when he lost everything, he had to go to a food bank. And because he had this work ethic, he realized, I've lost everything and I have to go to a food bank, but maybe I can help build up the food bank. And so he engaged with people there, and a large majority of those people were black, and they built up the food bank and they created other food banks. And by this point in the story, he's in tears and he's saying, I never really was alive. When I had my whole perfect life and I had my retirement security and I had my home, and I was living on an island of my prejudice, and I was never even alive. But now he was alive. He lost everything. He had to lose everything that created his isolation, and that allowed him to become a human being and connect with other human beings. It was a very wonderful story.
And I think that this is a good awakening for people to realize that we hear these stories over and over again. I lost everything.
Yeah.
Then I woke up.
Yeah.
And I think the key is that we don't have to lose everything if we implement some of these things to start with, if we realize that, okay, yeah, I've got a nice car and I've got a nice house and I've got this and I've got that, okay, but what am I going to do to be alive?
Yeah.
And people are alive in that space. They may have worked, they may have earned, they may have understood it. And then, you know, at the same point and the same token, there are people out there that don't really have all of these things and they're still not alive.
Right.
And so it comes back to that choice. Are we going to love? Are we going to give ourselves a life? Because that life is like turning on the water to come through the hose. You know, we can be the hose, we can be open, we can allow it to flow through us. But until we choose to be alive, the water doesn't come through, in a sense.
Absolutely. It's, we talked a little bit before the show about a technique, and I have a really simple, powerful technique that I'd like to offer to people, and that is, it's a question. Just, you know, check your state, and whenever you like, as often as you like, and just ask yourself, am I too afraid to be kind and encouraging right now? Am I too afraid to be kind and encouraging right now? Don't forget the right now. It's very important that you recognize on the spot right now. Am I too afraid to be kind and encouraging right now? And that can mean be encouraging to yourself and or kind and encouraging to someone else simultaneously. But just learn to face that and recognize if there is a fear there, relax. Practice relaxing. Have the courage. It takes courage. It takes courage to relax and not follow the fear. But if you ask that question, because that gives you the alternative, it's a lot easier to let go of something if you have an alternative. If you lecture yourself, let go of fear, let go of fear, it's very hard to do because, you know, deeper down, you know that when you let go of something, you need to have something else to hold on to. So if you just lecture, let go, let go, let go, you're going to resist that. But if you let go of the fear and take hold of being kind and encouraging, it gives you a way out. It's a very simple, wonderful, powerful technique.
Yes. And as you were saying this, you know, it's one of those things that you listen to, you know, sometimes, okay, come back and listen to this in the archives when you have your friends having the bad day. Put them right here to this point. And because sometimes you need to hear it from somebody else. And when you hear it from somebody else saying, okay, am I too afraid to be kind and encouraging right now? I mean, it's like, oh, man. Did I really just hear that? Like, am I really in that space that I can't even say a kind word to myself or somebody else? It's such a wake-up. It's such a wake-up, and it kind of makes you laugh, and it kind of makes you go, man, am I being really silly right now or what?
Yeah, it's very powerful. And, you know, we're so habituated to beating ourselves up. And so it's a very powerful technique. It's profound. It's like, wait a minute, am I too afraid? Because you have to cop to it that when you're beating yourself up, at the bottom line, if you really investigate it honestly, it always is about fear. So, you know, so what if you made a big mess? You know, I often say, you know, especially it's easy if someone has, like, if they have kids, it's like, you know, if your kid makes a big mess, are you going to beat him up or are you going to encourage him? Encourage him to learn from his mistake. Encourage him that he's bigger than the mistake. He can go on. You know, you don't beat people up, and that includes yourself. Everybody makes a special case. You know, everybody works very hard to be kind to other people. But they often leave a special case. I have people tell me all the time, I'm great, you know, I'm great with other people. I'm really kind. I'm really patient with other people. I'm just hard on myself. As if you're not a human being, as if there's some, you're some special other kind of being where it's okay to beat this special kind of being up. And I just say, you know, it's not okay. You're a human being. There is never an excuse for attacking yourself. You'd never attack them. Well, you can never attack yourself. I'm sorry. No special case.
Yes. And I think, too, we've kind of bred a society, and this comes back to, you know, those who choose to want to try to control others have made us believe that by being in the victim space, that's how we get attention and care and love.
Yeah.
When in reality, we're seeing a shift and people are waking up and realizing, hey, I really don't want to be controlled by other people, and I'm not going to play the victim no matter what direction my life goes, because I've definitely learned that doesn't really get me anywhere other than to bring some people into my life that I don't necessarily want there. And so now I'm stepping out of this, I can actually go in this whole different direction. We're shifting our society where the victim is no longer going to be the one getting all the attention. And people are looking for those who are willing to step out of that space and be an example.
Mm-hmm.
And just be themselves. I mean, for most people,
yeah.
It's not about, hey, I want you to go off and be some guru and teach me or something. It's just about, I just want you to be happy. I just want you to experience fulfillment and not be in this pain of being the victim.
Yeah, it's an act. A victim. There's a difference between being victimized and adopting a victim psychological posture. You know, somebody
mm-hmm.
can beat you up, and you have been victimized. But you have the ability and the right to keep your internal state free and not adopt a psychological state of being a victim. You can keep your self-respect. You can be kind and encouraging to yourself instead of following fearful thinking, which is what is... fearful thinking is how you create a victim mentality. And you're right, you know, we in a dysfunctional family, when we're little kids, we can learn that is the way we get attention. We can learn in a dysfunctional family that being forthright and straightforward about your needs or your desires, you just get slapped down. But if you act broken, then the person who was mean to you will suddenly be kind to you. And so it makes a very compelling situation to develop the ability to act like a victim. It's very understanding how people can invest in that when you consider the kind of family system they might have come out of. The thing is, it worked then and it made sense then, but once you're an adult, it's obsolete. You don't need to do that anymore. You can take care of yourself.
Definitely, and I think that this really comes back around, and you know, the only time we really are that so-called victim is when we choose to turn our power over to somebody else and be in that role. And the key is that's not where we're going to find the happiness, the fulfillment. Your concepts align very much with the work I do in compassion, that these self-judgments that we make, that I'm not worthy to step out of this role. But again, using this type of a checkpoint like what you've given here, am I too afraid to be kind and encouraging right now? And it's about bringing it in the present, because it's kind of like, do I really truly have anything to fear right now in this moment? And we really don't at any
right.
given moment. I mean, okay, if you've got, you know, a bear mauling you, yeah, okay, you got something right there.
That's fight
you
or
know.
Flight. That's not psychological fear. That's fight or flight. That's perfectly fine.
But the average person sitting at home going, oh my gosh, I'm worried about this, I'm worried about that, you know, one thing that we do know is the worry blocks our action, that stagnates us. And the second we're willing to let it go, we can get back and get moving again.
Do I have time to talk about the worry thing for a few minutes?
We've got just a few minutes here.
Okay.
To go.
If you look at the functionality of worrying, it takes focused attention and repetitive thinking about the object that you care about. So that's the same functional description of prayer. Focused attention, repetitive thinking about an object you care about. The difference is with the prayer, it's positive. With the worry, it's negative. So I tell people, look, worrying is just negative prayer. So if you find yourself worrying, just recognize, oh, I'm worrying. That means there's something I care about. What is it I care about? And when you recognize what it is you care about, then start praying about it. Invite benefit, invite support. Pray in a positive way. If you find yourself worrying, don't beat yourself up about it. Just take it as a good reminder. Oh, I'm worrying. There's something here I care about. See what it is and then start praying about it. Invite prayer. Invite for whatever is truly beneficial in this area to come to you. Pray about it with faith.
That's a really important piece right now, I would say, with people. And I think you've placed that in really good perspective. I like that concept. Worrying is like a negative prayer. It's like that warning sign that goes off in us. It's kind of like you hit that point where you say, whoa, I think I've ate a little too much, right? Your belly's aching a little bit, and it's like, hey, I ate a little too much there. I need to stop eating right now. These worries, these fears, they're the same kind of things there. They're to wake us up and say, whoa, wait a second. We need to pay attention here. We're not paying attention. Maybe we're on autopilot or something else at the moment, and we need to make this shift. And I love how you bring that up and you say it's, repetitive thinking of what we care about. I think most people don't think of worry in that sense, that this is something that I care enough about to worry, just like you care enough about your children to worry about them.
Yeah, if you didn't care, you wouldn't worry.
Right. If you didn't care, you wouldn't worry. And the fact that people say, well, I don't know if I've got the energy in me to bring the positive result. Well, you obviously do, because it's the same energy. You're able to focus your attention that much, and you're able to repetitively think about something. So it's just a matter of what you're going to think about or how you're going to think.
Yeah, you're already praying, so might as well pray in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
Invite assistance, invite guidance, invite clarity, enlightenment, invite good qualities.
Yes. That's a big piece in there. You definitely are sharing some very, very big pieces with this, Jack, which I am so appreciative of and I'm so grateful of. And these are the things that I love, because these things are actually so simple.
Yes.
And we make them so complex, and they don't need to be complex.
Yeah. It's very simple. Stop squeezing yourself. Ask yourself, am I too afraid to be kind and encouraging right now? And relax and start being kind and encouraging, which allows your creative energy to flow. You will solve all your problems much more creatively and much more wholesomely, with much greater benefit and in a much more enjoyable way, if you do it with kindness and encouragement than if you try to do it with fear. Fear is never your friend. It never helps, because it's just squeezing.
Yes, and that's...
You can't have fun doing anything if you're squeezing yourself at the same time that you're trying to do it.
Exactly. It never feels good when you're doing that. That's when we...
No.
Belly aches, headaches and everything else, right?
Yeah.
The physical results in that as well. But I think this is, again, some really amazing pieces that you've brought in. And I know in your work you do a variety of things. You work with, of course, the Finding True Magic, which is the key book based around what we've been talking about tonight, but you also have some other things on your website. And you also do what's called lucid heart therapy with people, which is really going into that heart space. So I would love for you to just kind of present, you know, how do people get in contact with you, you know, maybe go over your key things there that you're offering, and, you know, just go ahead and plug yourself a little bit.
Okay, great. Thank you. My website is findingtruemagic.com. Finding True Magic is the name of my book. I also have a blog that's blog.findingtruemagic.com. And I have a private practice. I work with individuals, couples, children, family. I work with business people as well as with individuals. I work on just about any kind of issue, whether it be professional or personal. I work with people all over the world by phone and Skype, as well as seeing people in person. I have a variety of individual products and seminar products and trainings on my website that people can study at a distance. I also do live trainings. I certify people as hypnotherapists. I've been doing all of this for 26 years. I have a free newsletter that you can subscribe to from my website, and my book also is in ebook form. You can get the ebook on Amazon or iTunes or Barnes and Noble. There's another one, I can't remember what it is, but anyway, it's easily accessible in hard copy or ebook form, and my work is—it's easy to get a hold of me. I have a bunch of YouTube clips. You can go check me out on YouTube and get a sense of what it's like to work with me and hear a lot of the same kinds of ideas that I've been talking about with Jesse tonight. Just remember, ask yourself, am I too afraid to be kind and encouraging right now? And then just let go and start being kind and encouraging. So I think that's everything. You can email me from my website.
I'll mention a couple of things that you have under your products on your website too, which is the Dating Survival Kit, for audio set. You've got your book, of course, Finding True Magic on there. You've got aspect of working with hypnosis for weight loss or health gain. Also to quit smoking and be free. You've got a two-hour video that's a product that you do that's Buddha and the Hypnotist and dealing with our waking conscious. And also you've got an aspect or a product down here that is Family Matters, 5 Ways to Stop Your Past from Screwing Up Your Future. That seems like it could be really interesting as well. On there. I love that aspect. It's like, yes, how do I get my past to stop screwing up my future? So some really great products on there, and I encourage people to go on and look around at what Jack's doing, the lucid heart therapy and the life coaching, and check into that because it's very heart-centered, very compassionate approach to working with things. And definitely Jack brings up these aspects of not only compassion with others but with yourself, and I think that's a big key because when we are compassionate with ourselves, it's a heck of a lot easier to be compassionate with other people around us. And again, you can find all of his work at findingtruemagic.com. It's at the bottom of the show description there. And Jack, I tremendously want to thank you for your time and your insights and your sharing that you've given tonight.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. And you, I really love the work you're doing. It's wonderful.
Thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it. Next week here on Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour, I'm going to have Peter Fenner on. He's going to be talking with us about his work in the Radiant Mind. So that's definitely going to be something to tune into. He's doing some amazing, amazing work and has a great deal to share with that. My books, again, on relationships have been released, and you can find the links to check those out and purchase them on my website at jessieannnicholsgeorge1.com. Again, those are the books You, Me, Life, Dreams, and the Companion Workbook, and they're designed to help you activate the perfect relationship for you. You'll learn how to find, develop, and maintain your perfect relationship, and you can learn how to understand what your partner is thinking, feeling, needing, and how to communicate in ways to strengthen your relationship and avoid drama. And I do want to mention that any of the books, the relationship books, You, Me, Life, Dreams, or the Companion Workbook, whether it's ebook or paperback, a portion of the what I take in on those books are being donated to Live and Let Live Farm Rescue during the month of December. So any purchases that are made on those books during the month of December, there will be anywhere from $2 to $5 per book donated to them. And they're a wonderful organization. If you're not up on the Live and Let Live Farm Rescue and the work that they're doing, I do encourage you to check them out in two different ways. liveandletlivefarm.org is their website, as well as Teresa Paradis, who coordinates all of that and operates all of that organization, was a guest on my show last fall. And you can certainly go back and check out the archives on that to find out more about that work. So I really encourage you for that, because I would love nothing more than to write, you know, a big check to them and support the work they're doing, because it's absolutely amazing there. And I am working on putting together the Compassion Tour. You can stay on top of the events for that at jessieannnicholsgeorge.eventbrite.com, as well as on my website. And if you'd like to find out more about the work I'm doing, again, on the website, you're going to find things like short videos. I put out a new one every month on that. You can find workshops that are going on. You can find my online courses, which there's a whole variety of things. There's also series on there regarding the relationships, regarding compassion, regarding chakras and how to work with the chakras, as well as moon cycles, new moons honorings and full moon honorings, and I've got a winter solstice honoring that's coming up with that. So lots of options there, very affordably priced to do things online with that. You can connect with me, see the different ways you can connect with me. You can find out, again, the archive shows are listed on there, as well as you can follow all of the hosts that are here on Main Street Universe and catch the archive shows throughout our entire network here. They're all listed on the site there. And that's all listed at the bottom of today's show description. The December special that I have running right now is my books Activating Compassion and the Companion Workbook are available for $4.99 each in paperback and $1.99 each in ebook, which is a huge, huge savings, because the paperbacks are usually $12.99 each and the ebooks are regularly $9.99 each. So this is a great way to also get a gift for somebody right now. You think about that, whether it's the relationship books or Activating Compassion, it's a great opportunity to give something at a very affordable price, as well as to help other people. And you can get all the details right there on my homepage at jessieannnicholsgeorge1.com. And don't forget, we've got several shows here on Main Street Universe throughout the week. Sunday nights we have Darren Bouquet, who's a reader at Madame Laveau in New Orleans. He does his show called Spiritual Insights. Monday nights we have Kevin Baird walking on the sidewalk with his Horizon Oracle's Journeys deck. This is a deck that he personally created for himself, and you can learn more about that deck at templeofgaia.com. Tuesdays, we have Susan Weed, who's sharing her work in herbs and natural plants. And I believe she just started a series on evergreens, if I'm correct on that. And Wednesday nights, our flagship show with Daniel and Janice and Brett. It's called Main Street Universe. So they're always bringing on different things, discussing different topics, or they also have some guests that come on the show from time to time as well. So it's just a kind of a variety of different things that's happening there. I definitely want to say, hey, this is Jesse Ann Nichols George, and thank you so much for being here tonight. And certainly, I look forward to seeing you back here next week as we delve more into activating compassion. But don't forget, if you've enjoyed the show tonight and Jeff shared some really, really great tips with us and some really great insights, you know, share it with other people. Get out there and let them know what you were listening to. And it's available right here at the same link in our archives. And they can listen to it at their convenience. It'll be available in about 5 minutes here or so, 10 minutes after we close down the show here tonight. And I'm going to leave you for that song with the song Yearning For Over and Over by Shem Shai. Again, an amazing group. Make sure you check out their work. They're on Facebook. If you just put in S-H-I-M-S-H-A-I, I know that they share, like I said, where you can go in and get some free song recordings every now and then. And they're just an amazing group of people. I want to thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you again next week right here on Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. May you enjoy the rest of your weekend and have an amazing week.
And if I could see what makes me blind, I would soar to the edge of my mind. And to touch what seems unreal, just to show you the way that I feel. And we are in time with time, one with the season of change and tide. And we are in tune with the tune, caught in a balance of sun and moon. Oh, deep inside, the light within, shining to show you it's here to begin. When all I have is all I need, I will soar to the edge of eternity. And we see it eye to eye, one within love to be for the divine. And we're walking hand in hand, caught in the balance of God and man. Over and over, life is your lover, learning to walk just a little bit slower. Whispering secrets, I bet you can't keep it. No turning back now, this time we reveal it. To another, all will discover the essence within the most beautiful lover. Time is still turning, the love is still burning. Deep in your spirit, your heart still yearning for. Within love to be free.
Still yearning for over and over, life is your lover.